Blog Talk Radio.
Finest hour on the radio. And then today got guest appearance by Phil Jackson. Going to get to that shortly. Make sure to go on Cameo so you can hire me for shout-outs or anything you want me to do. Reach out to me. Hire me through there. Also, go on K9Magazine.com/hypnotic to peep the interview that I did in July. And then I'm going to make sure to start your day off right with Hypnotic Coffee at hypnoticcoffee.com. Right now to Phil Jackson.
From the beginning of seeing the game till now, what have been the biggest changes you've seen?
Well, the three-point line changed the game dramatically.
When did that happen?
The unification of the American basketball, ABL, ABA. There was an ABL at one time, but the ABA and the NBA. When the two leagues united, the three-point line came with the ABA. And there were maybe six times it would be shot. Sometimes there was not a three-point shot taken. And then Houston had a team with guys that could shoot three-pointers towards the end of Rick Barry's career and Rudy Tomjanovich's career. So they started exploiting it a little bit, and then it took off where they're, you know. But in the finals, even in the 90s when we played Utah, they were the least three-point shooting team in the league. They took 13, 14 a game. Not teams take 30. It might
just
be
because culturally they never got into it?
There was a good shot. It wasn't a high-percentage shot.
Yeah.
They also had a terrific interior player named Malone, Carl Malone.
Yeah.
So there was that part of it. But at some point, the Europeans kind of exploited it, and people bought into the fact that, two three-point shots is 6 points. It takes three of those baskets to make 6 points. It's a difference that makes sense. So that's the way it started, and it continued. And it was good. It was a good deal. But what happened that bothers the basketball people that enjoy the game is the rest of the game kind of fell apart. So guys walk and travel and don't know how to pivot. They can't dribble the ball correctly. And all these things that you see also are happening in baseball and happened in football. You know, they lowered the mound in baseball. That was back in the 60s because they started hitting. Guys were not hitting 300. So they dropped the mound. And then the fences were like, the polo field was like 460 in New York City. The fences now are smaller than the baseball field I grew up in with that 306 at center field and 298 down the lines. Some major league teams are like, those are high flies. They're knocking them out of the park.
Because the game seems more exciting for the fans if there's more points.
I don't know. I don't know if it's true or not, but, three-point shooting. Yeah, I went to a game this week. I go to a game a year.
One game a year.
Well, I went one last year. I don't know if I went one the year before. I don't think I went one the COVID lockout
year. Typically one a year.
Yeah. There's something that will bring me there. So I went to the game, and one team hadn't made a three-point shot in like 8 minutes. And I was there with my grandkids, and the boys were like, wow, they can't shoot at all. They're not shooting at all. I said, they'll find a way. Someone will get hot, and then they'll get going. At some point, they'll start making them. But yeah, it was a dearth. And so they're casting up these long shots, and the rebounds are long rebounds. So then the opponent then can run because unfettered, because there's no defense back. And so it's blown the game kind of wide open. And it's become difficult for people and players that have watched the game evolve to enjoy this form of the game a lot. Some of the guys I coached, they're talented, Phil. They're really talented players. I know, but I'm not enjoying the games. It's That's too bad. There's a new generation that'll like it. They'll like the game. So.
Do you still watch a lot of basketball or
no? I don't.
Tell me about that. When and did you stop immediately from the time you stopped coaching?
No, I didn't. I watched some of the game evolve and decided, and they went into the lockout year and they did something that was kind of wanky. They did a bubble down in Orlando,
mm-hmm.
and all the teams that could qualify mm-hmm. went down there and mm-hmm. stayed down there.
Mm-hmm. No audience.
And they had things on their back like, you know, Justice and, yeah, I made a little funny thing like, you know, Justice just went to the basket and Equal Opportunity just knocked him down. And somebody, I had another name for a guy who has jersey in the back of a jersey. He had some other slogan. So my grandkids thought that was pretty funny to play up those names. So I couldn't watch that. And the Lakers won, actually. They won that year. And
do you feel like it just made little of the game, like it made it like a sideshow? What do you think it was that turned you off?
Well, it was they even had slogans on the floor, on the baseline. It was catering. It was trying to cater to an audience or trying to bring a certain audience into play. And they didn't know it was turning other people off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People want to see sports as non-political.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had a lot of different type of players that have gone on to be, like, you know, Bill Bradley was a senator, number of baseball players been representatives and senators and political, but their politics stay out of the game.
Yeah, it's separate.
Doesn't need to be there.
Yeah. Tell me about competition and the difference between playing to win and playing your best.
Okay, so we have the term. Play beyond your opponent and play beyond the refereeing. So you're not trying to understand the scoring or what the opponent's doing. You're just playing for your guys that are with you on the team and doing the things that create the best feeling for your group of guys. And when there's a bad call or there's something that goes against you in the referees, no mind.
That's not part of what you're doing.
Right. You're just playing. Yeah. So you're not involved in that. So, you know, some guys, I actually got them to get like a rubber band and put around their, you know, just snap the rubber band, bring yourself back.
Present moment.
I had this statement, one mind, one breath type of thing, you know, that we used to sit as a team, you know, before days of shoot around or, you know, sometimes even previous to a game, we just sit in quiet space. We knew what we had to do. There was no need to talk, just be quiet and sit and get centered. So, yeah, just trying to get guys to get centered and to leave all that noise behind sometimes really important.
And were some more receptive to that than others?
Oh, yeah. You know, there's a lot of kids that have grown up in this generations, the last couple of generations, that deal with attention deficit. There's, you know, asthma is another thing, you know, that just prevent people from just being able to be really clear and have quiet space. Sometimes I have to take a player out and sit him down and just say, you know, this is time just to be quiet. Just get yourself centered. Call a timeout. There's, you know, the certain rule. It's a first minute's yours. Go to the bench, towel off. Your teammates will talk to you. You communicate among yourselves. When I step in, get up off the bench, join me in a circle. We'll talk about the next. We'll go out and do it. Give them the space to get themselves back and centered and whatever. And then I'd step in and they'd be up and ready to go after it. And teammates would be around them. And I could spend a minute with my staff and talk about what's going on. And we had one guy that was plotting everything, you know, just like your board there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lined sheet of paper and, you know, 9x11 or whatever. And there are 25 plays in a quarter. What's happened in the last 6 or 8? between the timeouts? Is there any trend that you want to talk about? And you'll get input, because my coaching staff, they each had a team. And so with 30 teams and three coaches, 10 each. Usually there's some teams you play four, some teams in the East you play two. But it kind of balanced it off so they weren't overwhelmed. So they would do the prep and they would do the pregame preparedness. And then during the game, they would talk about what's going on with the other team. When are they bringing in the subs? What's their post timeout thing that they like to go to? What do they do? So yeah, kind of get some
information.
Anything
like this? This is something that worked against this player in the past. This is a weakness. Like pointing out things like weaknesses of other players.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's a certain frame to that, and you know, one of the very difficult games that we had to play, a seventh game in the series against Sacramento in 2002. Rick Fox, who was an alternate captain, came over and said, yeah, Shaq and Kobe been carrying the load. I got a guy I can take, you know. Let's get the ball to me, and I'll see if I can't break some defense down or get some baskets for us with a little easier. So, yeah, he took three possessions, 6 points, and, you know, we kind of kept the momentum going. So, yeah, I like it when players volunteer and help. My coach, Red Holtzman, timeout. All right, you motherfuckers. You've been lazy out there. You're not getting out on the defense. You're letting guys catch the ball. You're not contesting shots. Let's get some bodies on bodies out there, da-da-da-da-da. Okay, what do you guys want to run? Dave, what do you want to do out there? Willis, you got someone you want to take? What do you guys want? Well, let's go inside to Willis. He hadn't touched the ball a couple times on the court, so, you know, that was gave a lot of freedom to the team. Defense? No, this is us doing everything together. This is a five-man operation. Offense? Who can, you know, someone take off? So when I came to the Lakers, I was like, basketball is kind of like a jazz quintet. You know, one guy riffs off another guy and someone gets to play a little bit of a lead or whatever. That's kind of what happens in basketball. There's a lot of times in the offense I run, it's whoever gets open that's going to end up with the ball. It's not always going to be so-and-so that's going to have a... One of the guys is a jock on jazz. How about Coltrane? Nope, not Coltrane. Coltrane, he wouldn't put that axe down. He had to play 40 minutes sometimes all by himself.
Yeah.
We don't want to have that happen.
Yeah,
it's a famous thing with Miles Davis. Coltrane, put that fucking axe down. You've been playing 40 minutes. Yeah, it's That was maybe Miles Davis's best group, though. That quintet with John Coltrane in it.
I remember hearing you say that you like the team to play in 4-4, like to play in rhythm. Explain that to me. I want to picture that.
Okay. So there's a certain beat that we like to play on. If you have the ball longer than two count, you're holding up the team. You either activate the ball, shoot it, dribble it, or pass it. But once you're beyond that level, something's stalling the organization out. Because the players are all in concert, moving together. And so if it gets beyond that two and the third beat, now their spacing is disoriented, their timing's off, and there's a certain rhythm that has to go with it. So the passing was really like a rhythm thing. I call it communication. You communicate with each other by passing the ball.
Mm-hmm. And it opens up new opportunities. Every time the ball's passed, everybody resets.
So, yeah, there's a certain format that, you know, we organized. And it's called an overload, because we overload one side of the floor, which gives an open area on the other side of the floor because there's not enough defenders over there. And so we use an overload. to set it up. And so to overload, you have to fill that corner and fill the space. So it takes a couple seconds to get into that. So in the process of doing that, you had a certain activity. You did footwork, you did motion, you do penetration, whatever. You might start a passing operation that's going, but then if it's not activated within 2 seconds, then you're holding things up. People are on the way, they're on the move, and they're ready to go.
Yeah. Is there any preconceived idea in coaching, or is it all in the moment based on either the person in front of you or the situation you're in?
So going in, there's a certain, okay, this is what we're going to work on here with this particular thing. And if I had a player that was an outstanding scorer, which is a talent, the lead singer, a scorer, guards going forward, what do you see? What have you visualized? Because we talk about visualization a lot. What have you visualized will work against this team? For myself, after, you know, morning shoot around, maybe a little salad lunch or whatever, one little workout maybe, two, take a 45-minute nap at three, get up, put on my zoot suit, and get ready for the bus at five. During that 45-minute thing, it's a whole process. I see you leaning back here, eyes closed, mm-hmm. headphones on, full of whatever that sound is that you're trying to feel it out. So the same thing, I'm doing similar thing in a situation. What does a visualization look like here? What is the activity level that's going to disrupt what this team is planning to do? We certainly know what their strengths are on the other end of the floor, how they score. But what are they going to try and do to stop? They're going to take the ball away from Michael.
So it's almost like ESP that you're doing. Yeah. You're trying to imagine what's going to happen tonight.
That's right. So we got in a Donnybrook game one time in San Antonio. It was like one of these games that, you know, the crowd's going nuts and, you know, the San Antonio fans are notorious. And we're playing our balls to the wall game, and it's fun. And I keep telling them, we're going to win this game. But I just got that feeling this is our game to win. Things go wrong. Tim Duncan hits a three-point shot or an out-of-balance shot. We're down by 1 point. I don't know if there's a second left on the clock. I think it's less than a second. So I line them up. This is what we're going to do. Go out on the floor. Out of bounds guy, Gary Payton's taking the ball out of bounds. He's a good passer. Calls timeout. Okay. The guy that's guarding him played for us for 3 years, Robert Horry. He knows exactly what we're going to do. You're going to have to go to the guy that's open here. He's going to be poaching on Shaq or Kobe or whoever else. You just have to hit the open guy. So we'll go break out and do it again, okay? Do it again. Fish catches the ball. Derek Fisher catches the ball. Back to the 6-1 guard. Shoots a turnaround jump shot and hits it with less than a second. Well, there's only a second to start with. Catch and shoot is all he can do. Can't dribble. That turn and shoot the ball. Goes in, we win the game.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
How does it happen?
And, you know,
you talk in the book that you talk a lot. There are many examples of a miraculous shot. That sounds like a miraculous shot that
yeah.
you just described. What goes into a miraculous shot?
Well, I think the impossibility of the situation, you know, the one that Michael made to finish out Last Dance, that was all programmed. They scored with 40 seconds to go. They were up by 3 points. I called a timeout. And I said, we're going to do this, and you're going to have this opportunity. But I know the coach is not going to call a timeout for the other team. Jerry Sloan will not call a timeout. He'll expect his team to come down and score. And they'll do the same thing that you guys know. They'll run a post play inside, cross pick by the guard, Michael, you'd come back and steal the ball from Malone right there. And we'll go down and run the same situation, but we'll have a, you just make an adjustment on it. No timeouts. You won't see that ever in this day and age. After Michael scores this incredible shot where he, well, I told him during the timeout, you've been shooting the ball and you've got tired and now your hand's dropping. So when you shoot your shot, make sure you follow through with your hand. So he follows through, the ball goes in, we are up by 1 point. Now they call a timeout. Now there's like, I don't know, less than whatever, 4 seconds or whatever. Now they call a timeout. But that's, you don't see plays like that where there's no timeouts. There would usually be like 3 timeouts in this day and age.
Yeah.
Coaches would want to control it. My counterpart down there, Jerry Sloan, had a similar background as I had about their team knew what to do and when to do it. They're really intuitive to each other. So anyway, it was a miraculous shot, but yet we knew what was going to happen, and he knew what was going to happen. He knew what to do. There was a situation similar to that the year before, in the final game of the year before, where John Stockton had been leaving his man and coming over and trapping Michael, and they stole a ball from him. And in the next game, there was the final game of the series, the sixth game. I said, Michael, you know what's going to happen. John Stockton, as soon as you turn your back or you move into that position, he's coming. So Steve Kerr's going to be right behind you. Just put it on his hands. Steve made the shot. And, you know, then he told a funny story at this Graham Park ceremony they had for the team afterwards that was kind of hilarious. As I told Michael, I'm going to be opening in this whole bit, which is funny, which is definitely a Steve type of thing. It's interesting to see Steve in that whole sequence. He's like really excited about doing it. He's like a sixth man, you know, he didn't play starters minutes, but he was a dead-eyed shooter. And at one time had the best three-point shooting percentage of any player in the NBA. Now his player, Steph Curry, has passed him by with the highest percentage three-point shooter. So it's funny.
How much of three-point shooting is practice?
Well, when Steve came to us, we knew he was a good shooter. My colleague, Tex Winter, and I had gone to watch him play his final college game, and he had a knee operation in between then and coming to the pros, so he sat out a year. So he came to the NBA a year out of college without playing and had no opportunities, very few opportunities to play, a little here, a little there. But we kept an eye out, and when he became available, we went and got him. His high school predecessor at his high school in Pacific Palisades, right down the street here, was going to law school at DePaul in Chicago. I played against him in the Philippines. It's a funny thing. He was in the Philippines. He went to Duke. He was in the Philippines playing, you know, exercising against Basketball Jones or whatever, getting it out of his system. And he said, this is it for me. I'm going to go to law school. And he called me up and said, Steve Kerr wants me to come and help him shoot before practice. Is there a way I can do that? I said, you can have the court until X amount of time. You can have it from 9:30 to 10. He said, I'll be there. We're gonna do it. And he was like 3 years ahead of Steve Kerr at Pacific Palisades. They both went to the same high school. So Steve really respected his shooting. He's now 15 years with San Antonio, maybe 20 years with San Antonio. He's become the quintessential shooting coach in the NBA. But so he went and started shooting with Steve. And then Steve brought some of his teammates in, and they started shooting together, and it became like let's shoot together and do this type of thing. So they'd shoot like 50 shots, 100 shots, three-point shots, which is, takes some work. By the time I got back to the NBA after taking a hiatus and being off for a year, they had a lockout that year. I came back. The teams were now playing a game. Players on the team were playing a game called CAT. So they go to 4 or 5 different spots on the corner, top of the top of the key, angle, three-point lines in the other corner, and they shoot knockout. They play a game called knockout. So player makes it in front of you, you got to make it, or else you get knocked out of the game. So then it starts over. Then you try to make the shot and knock the guy out behind you. So then they get down to the final two guys. And so then once he's do this, they're still, coach, don't start practice yet. We're still not done with the game. Okay, I'll give you guys 5 minutes to do it. Kobe, why don't you ever shoot with these guys? I'm not a three-point shooter. I want to go to the basket. I want to take it to them inside. That'd be my boy, Kobe. He was like giant killer. You're going to get knocked down. Eventually, you're going to have to learn how to shoot these threes, the jumper. That'll be a time I'll be ready for that time. But right now, I'm going to the basket. But he became a great three-point shooter.
Absolutely. Amazing. Well, did you ever see a player that you thought could be Michael, could be Kobe, but for whatever reason, it just never came together? Like, you saw the promise, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, there's a couple players that were actual contemporaries of theirs. Vince Carter is one of them. And he was really good, and he won the dunk contest, and, you know, he had a long career. He played until he was 40. He had a really good career. But he just didn't have that X factor.
And is the X factor a desire to win or something different than that?
I think a lot of these guys like to compete and they like to win. But inciting it, it's kind of like the drummer. If he can get the whole band playing together, if somebody can carry not only his end of the bargain, his scoring, but also excite his teammates and get them involved in it too. You know, that's the real thing that makes teams click. Come on, guys. I mean, the first year I was a head coach with the Chicago, we'd be playing Detroit, and Michael had been knocked down on the floor 5 times. I go in there at halftime, I go like, coaches, let's meet outside of the locker room. I know Michael's probably going off in there. He's probably irate because these guys are playing scared. They're afraid they're going to get knocked down, and he's got to go in there. Now, to be fair, when I was assistant coach, we had an all-out brawl with his team, the Bad Boys, they called them, the Detroit Bad Boys. And I had a clipboard on my lap, and I sat there, and of course, you know, my knees are up to my chin when I'm sitting on those kind of seats they have. They sit below the court, and the court is this much higher than the chair. So I'm sitting there, and my colleague, Johnny Bach, runs out. He's 65 years old or more, runs out there and grabs a guy that's, 6'10", 300 pounds. And the guy takes his hand and removes his hand and tears the ligaments in his wrist and his thumb. I said, Johnny, what did you think you were going to do when you went out there? These aren't just normal people. These guys are extremely strong and extremely big. Doug Collins went out there. He was the coach at the time. And they threw him onto the scorer's desk, literally took him and threw him on the scorer's desk. Now, he was like 195 pounds or 200 pounds. He wasn't a big guy, 6'4". But, you know, that's, you know, how big and how the effort. You don't want to go out there and get yourself in a mess, you know. So some of these players played intimidated. Well, that year Scottie Pippen got a concussion from a blow he got from one of the players on Detroit. During the playoffs, he couldn't play the second half. And, you know, the final game, he had a migraine the next year, and that was a pressure. You know, his mom had died. There's a bunch of stuff that gone into it, but he had a migraine. He couldn't play. So everybody's like, what's with Scottie Pippen? Is he a winner or not a winner? What's going on with this guy? You know, he missed the game last year with a concussion. That was the final game. This year he hit it. That all went under the bridge, under the water. He started winning, and he was like, came back from the Olympics, the Dream Team Olympics in 92. Michael Jordan came down the office, and we were getting ready to start the season. He said, Scottie Pippen's the second best player in the NBA. I said, oh, who's the best? Come on, you know who's the best.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it was revealing for him because there's Larry Bird and you know, Charles Barkley and you know, all these guys that were.
Do you still keep in touch with players or not so much?
I don't.
Any reason or just?
Well, I'm not a phone guy. Yeah. I've kind of left guys alone. I've never kind of been on their case.
Yeah.
When I get them on the court or get them in the team film room or whatever, in my office, I really like to have conversations, but I haven't chase down any players. And this week they retired a number for Pau Gasol, one of our key players here. Mm-hmm. We liked him. He was intelligent, really smart guy. Spoke Spanish, not Mexican, Spanish,
mm-hmm.
which he says is considerable difference. I had to learn Mexican. But he speaks German and he speaks French. They retired his number, 16. And I went to the game. I didn't go to the pregame, postgame parties that were afterwards. And like six of my players were there. And I was like, I missed out on it. But, you know, I was like, it's too much. I'm got a little knee issue going on. And it was just, you know.
I have a feeling I don't have a knee issue going on. And I don't go to those things either. And I don't know why. There's something strange about it where I don't know. I think if we're people who live in the present moment, we're in the present moment.
I hate crowds. I saw you at the Abbott concert at Shrine. Were they at Shrine and you were in the audience?
Yeah. That's the first time I saw them. Might have been the first time I saw
maybe
them.
Maybe 5 years ago or something.
More. Yes. When they played at the Shrine, it was probably 10, 12, 15 years, a long time ago.
Right. Bless their hearts, those boys.
They're unbelievable. Beautiful people. The nicest people I know.
They have a nice spiritual background. They have fathers are, you know, they've been brought up right.
Yeah. I asked when I met their father, I said, what did you do? I never met anyone like these kids. And he said, I'll tell you what I do. I back them. I back them. Whatever they say, I back them. And he said, if someone came to me and said one of my kids killed someone, I would have said, they must have needed killing.
Yeah.
Amazing. What's the range of coaching styles? What would be the opposite of the way you coach?
Well, I wrote something about it. One's transactional. The other's transformational.
Mm.
So when I went to graduate school,
mm-hmm.
in the off season of my first couple, 3 years as an NBA player, you know, you're making $12,000 a year. You're going to be playing the game you love. And then what are you going to do?
Yeah. What did you study?
Psychology.
Uh-huh.
Two guys, Ellis and Maslow,
mm-hmm.
were the prominent psychologists at the time. They were doing group therapy a lot at the time. And they both had this school that became known as transformational psychology. You can imagine what it means, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Transactional, my way, the highway type of thing, you know. More like, you know, Pat Riley's coaching style. And Pat's a terrific coach.
Terrific coach in a different way, in the opposite way.
Demanding.
Yeah.
You know, get the job done, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Transformational, I learned this, you know, when I was there. In fact, was really interested in the dynamics of my Knick team because of that bonding that we had as a group. We really bonded. It was like, you know, we're the toast of the town. Go to a party here, go to a party there. Howard Cosell was right behind us. I'm going to be around these guys. It's so much fun to be around them type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The next sequence of guys that we had in 73 weren't like that at all. We had a group of guys that respected their professional capabilities, but they'd grown into different paths and married and whatnot, you know, things like that happened. So I had a couple of different types of teams that I saw were extremely successful. But I knew that from my background, with my dad being a pastor, my mom being a caregiver and a minister of her own, that this is what they were, this is their message. This is a community. We love you. We support you. God willing, your life is going to be blessed and honored, and we'll help you on your way. And giving people that kind of solid base or understanding, and then having a standard. Here, you have to be able to meet the criteria that we have. This is a system that we all have to play with and in, and you have to learn this system. But show that you want to learn it. You want to learn it, you get a chance to play, and then we'll see how you do. And once you kind of get the feeling of this thing and you can play without thinking about it, it's innate, you're in.
Yeah. How hard is it to learn?
We say it takes a month. I used to say Thanksgiving, we'll know about this team. And that's maybe 14 games in or so,
yeah,
something like that. But, you know, usually it's we teach people how to catch the ball, how to pivot, how to use footwork, how to get to a position where you can receive the ball, how to pass to the open side. So the passing drills, dribbling drills, footwork drills.
And some people take to it faster than others.
Or... yeah, they've had the training. So we look for players that have good coaching. None of that works in basketball now. There's none of that applies to basketball. There's still footwork for a pivot for big guys.
Tell me about how teams get assembled. So when you get hired to coach a team, the team's already assembled. You have no...
not really. I mean, we brought in two players the first year I was here, and Jerry West, who was extremely good at that, was a general manager. We brought in one of my former players from Chicago named Ronnie Harper, and we brought in a guy named Sally, John Sally,
yeah,
who was a backup to Shaq.
I met him on the beach one time. Seemed like a great guy.
Yeah, you know, he's a really affable
seemed
guy.
Seemed like a great guy.
And he'd come into my office or my dressing room or whatever, and he'd say, "Coach, Shaq is worried that you don't like what he's doing." "What do you mean?" "You never give him any praise." "Oh, no, he's doing exactly what I expect him to do." "Does he need praise too?" Or when this story that I like to tell. Shaq is always overweight. After his first couple of seasons, he just got huge. Now he's over 300 pounds, right? So we go to training camp and everything. I say, "Shaq, you got to lose some weight, whatever." "You know, we have to get a grain scale to weigh the guy, right? You can't weigh him on a normal scale." So one of the first games, regular season, he's coming off the floor. It's early in the ball game, and I walk up and I, "Shaq, what's the greatest thing Wilt Chamberlain ever did?" "Well, he averaged 50 points a game and 40 rebounds, 30 rebounds a game." "So that's great numbers. But you know the real thing that's the greatest? He played every minute of every game. He played over 48 minutes a game. Do you think you can do that?" "If he did it, I can do it." 2 weeks later, John Sally comes into my, "You know, Phil, Shaq's feeling like he's getting pretty tired, you know." "Maybe he should take him." I said, "Yeah, he's in pretty good shape, though, isn't he?"
It's so funny. It's so funny. It's just like the right challenge for the right guy who needs the challenge.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's the only year he won an MVP title or an MVP award. He was terrific. He was really great. He had a toe from having feet that outgrew his shoes. So his big toe was like this. So when he pushed, that's the one you push off of. When he pushed off, this joint got worse and worse and worse. Until it's so arthritic, he was like, "Oh, man, my feet are killing me. Get an operation. Help him fix it." Ballet dancers do this all the time. Waited and waited and waited. And I can remember September 11th, following the big day on September 11th, they're still celebrating 9/11. He had the operation at UCLA. I went down to see him at UCLA. His statement was, "My time is playtime in the summertime. I'll get the operation on the team's time." Well, Kobe took that as a direct insult. I'm like, he doesn't really want to win. So that's where their feud really kind of, you know, they had a little kind of issues about that one. That was really a tough one for him to cross. I was like, "Yeah, I know the big guy doesn't want to play 82 games, Kobe. It gets tiring after a while, and then hauling that big body around, whatever. Taking the abuse he takes, guy's whacking on him like he's a, you know, man of steel." So, yeah, there are a lot of things to make up for it, but there's still that innate desire in Kobe that Shaq didn't have quite have that same killer instinct.
Well, he didn't need it because he was Shaq. He had a different, he brought something else.
Right. And he really wasn't a bully, but he could bully.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a bully.
Yeah.
I know guys that play bully ball, play basketball as bully ball. But he really wasn't a bully. But he'd test you out. He'd give you that shoulder in the chest thing. How do you like that? That was hard on my chest.
Yeah.
I had a, he used to, blame me for the Hack a Shaq thing, because when I was coaching in Chicago and they were in Orlando, I had three centers. I'd say, you guys have 18 fouls?
Wow.
And when you knock him down, make sure he goes down so he has to pick himself up. But just do it if he gets an offensive rebound. You know, I don't go for that other stuff of just whacking a guy.
Yeah.
But if he gets his own rebound or an offensive rebound, you can't let him put it back. He's unstoppable that way. And don't let him complete. So I had the three-headed monster. That's what they called it. They had the three heads of the centers on a T-shirt.
You talk in the book about the right way to play the game. What does it mean?
I see Steve still says the basketball gods, that's the term we used. You know, hit the open man. That's my coach's statement. Basketball is a pretty simple game. You hit the open man, and you see the ball on defense. That's it.
That's the right way to play.
Yeah. Get the ball up, set a pick, whatever. Yeah. Do the thing that comes naturally in basketball, and everything will work out.
Where's the line between gamesmanship and cheating?
Well, baseball's history, they've been stealing signs and stealing base running signs, you know, whatever. They've been using pine tar. They've been using cork bats. They've been using whatever. So baseball's rent with that. It's just part of the game. It's kind of a gamesmanship thing. And there's a lot of whining, especially here in L.A. after the Houston Astros won the World Series. They beat both the Yankees and the Dodgers and that's that year. Basketball, my coaches used to say, we go down to North Carolina, North Carolina State, not Dean Smith and the University of North Carolina, North Carolina State, and the coach there would have a great dinner, steak dinner for the referees, and maybe company later after the meal. So I get a couple calls the next day on the floor. You knew the referees were coming in. That's kind of how you get at it in basketball, is to try and change that. The Celtics used to have nets that were like flush the ball through. And other people had nets that would hold the ball, and you always had to take the ball out of the rim so the teams couldn't run. Well, the league got to it, and he said, we're going to make the nets now. So the league stopped that. One of the equipment I carried on the floor was a needle that lets the air out of the ball. Mm-hmm. We played basketball. We wanted the ball that you could put your thumb in the skin of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want rebounds bouncing all over the place. We wanted
so if it was overfilled, it would change the game.
Bounce too much. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to box out so we could get the rebounds by the basket. We didn't want that ball bouncing the free throw line. The league stopped allowing that to happen. Even though it says on the ball, this ball can be inflated from 7 to 9 PSI, pounds per square inch.
So you preferred it closer to 7 than 9?
We got it at 7, And the league now has the referees, and they mark the balls. So they've tried to take that out. The rims used to be a little bit wanky. They're called toss-back rims, and you can pull them down, and they go back up so that they don't break the backboard.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them are tighter than others, so the ball hits, it doesn't go in, it just knocks the ball off the backboard and out. Oh, here's something I used to do. The league, in its infinite ignorance, has NBA Finals in a great big plastic decal at half court. And they put it on half court, so when the camera's on the game, there it is, 1995 or 2015 NBA Finals, on both sides of the court.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are as slippery as can be. If there's a wet spot on that thing, go and play full court defense against your opponent, because they can't stay on their feet. It's like a skating rink. They're slippery as can be, especially if they're wet. So,
and everybody's sweating, so they get wet.
Yeah,
you can't help but get wet.
You know, when I goes to Puerto Rico, I had a guy, Torres, when he ran, there'd be the footprint of sweat right where his tennis shoe was. And all squish out, and there would be a puddle of, in Puerto Rico, they call them mapos. Hey, mapo, get this But there's a number of things like that. Here's one that was great. Red Auerbach, who's one of the great competitors and a fine coach. Boston Celtics won 9 championships as a coach, won a couple as a general manager. We went there. They had the home court advantage that year because they'd won 68 games. They had a great year, and the rivalry was tremendous. We were there 4 times, 2 at our home court, 1-1, and 1, 7th game. Every game we played, there was a different locker room. We had the visitors' hockey room. We had another different...
Just make you uncomfortable.
Just anything.
Anything to make you uncomfortable.
The 7th game, we had to sit outside the ring. And in Boston, they had this grandstands, and then they had a ring where all the pedestrians would hang out during halftime. And so to get off the court, we had to walk through all the pedestrians to get to this. I call it a janitor's closet.
Yeah.
It was like a janitor's closet. We got beer thrown on us, whatnot, going out that thing. But that's a Red Auerbach special. And the other thing he would do is that he wouldn't send the tickets down. The players get 2 tickets each. So there's, you know, like 24, 30 tickets maybe for a whole team,
mm-hmm.
coach, trainer, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
He'd send the tickets down half hour before the game. So players are going out to the court to start their warm-ups. And they'd say, trainer, Danny, I put the ticket envelope for, you know, Will Smith.
Distraction.
On my locker. So when the tickets come, put the... Right.
And mind off the game.
Right.
Amazing.
And the Celtics used to play them all the time, the Lakers all the time. The Lakers would say, that old building, they crank up the heat. It's 105 degrees in the locker room. And it'd be, you know, in the middle of June.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Amazing.
Those are little things that go on in the game.
When you're playing in the heat of the moment and the ball gets thrown to you, tell me what goes on inside. Is it thinking? Like, what? How do you know what to do in the heat of the moment? It's happening. It's fast.
Yeah.
What happens? Tell me the process of what it feels like. And what you think is going on inside you.
Right. Well, the first thing we taught, and I am part of this for having experience,
yeah.
is how close am I being guarded? Do I have a shot? Should I be passing the ball? Is there a passing sequence?
Are you aware of this even before you have the ball in your hand?
Right.
What's my situation?
Is there a body on body right now?
Okay.
Do I have to elbow a guy off to get to the basketball?
Okay.
How am I catching the ball?
That's the first rule.
Yeah, how far am I away from the ball basket, and what's going on in the game? What's the game situation? And we tell a guy, those are your 2 seconds, shoot or pass or penetrate. So you look for the shot if you're wide open. You look for a pass if your teammates are open, hit the open man, or then you penetrate and you get.
So you only have 3, you're only picking from 3.
Yep.
Before you pick, you're seeing whether you're guarded or not, because if you're guarded, it makes the shooting less of a chance. Is
right.
that correct?
Yep.
So you're more likely to eat. Well, you have to either penetrate.
First rule of a sound offense, must penetrate the defense.
Yeah.
First rule. You must get the penetration.
Yeah.
And you can penetrate by 3 ways. You can penetrate by dribble, by pass, by offensive rebound. The offensive rebound is the most dangerous of all of them. Because you've rebounded
You're
close
right there.
To the basket.
You're right there.
Now, as soon as you rebound close to the basket, there are 2 3-point shooters that are standing out there.
Yeah.
All their lives, these 3-point shooters have hired people to catch the ball they shoot and pass it to them from the basket out to where they're standing. So they are used to the ball coming from this direction and shooting it back where it came from.
And that's Dennis Rodman is good at that, at getting the ball.
Dennis would get on he'd lift weights to activate himself. Then he'd get on a bicycle. He'd ride a bicycle for, I don't know, 15 minutes so he'd get a sweat. All the time he's riding a bicycle, he'd be watching the opponent. He'd watch where the opponent's shots came off. Does this guy shoot long? Does he shoot short? Does his shot go off the backboard? Does he shoot from the corner and the ball skips this way or that way? Okay, now he's got an idea what he's playing against. Now he goes in to shower. He showers. The meeting started because it's like, I don't know, 25 minutes to the game. We go out at 15 minutes before the game. Guys have been out shooting, getting themselves ready, come in, maybe put on a new jock strap, dry shorts and a shirt and their jersey and whatnot. They're all sitting in their chairs. Dennis walks out of the shower, butt-ass naked, with a towel over his head, goes, sits down in his locker. There's 10 minutes left before the game, before he's dressed. All the players are coming in. Dennis, we got to go out. Dennis, we have to go out. Leave him. Just leave him. Go out and shoot. No, no, we got to go out together. Got to go. Okay. Dennis, get out there and get the team in. 10 minutes is enough to shoot. These guys have shot before the game.
Of course.
Amazing. He's always making these shooters. They're waiting. They're antsy, waiting in the hallway. Get your ass out here, Dennis.
But it doesn't, like, the perception of him is that he's a screw-up. But what you're describing is not a screw-up.
Not at all.
He seemed methodical about the game. He did all of the practice that he needed to do his job. And he studied the other team and was diligent about his job.
I don't know if anybody rebounds at the level he rebounds even today in this sport with guys that are, you know, whatever. I think the best height for basketball is like 6'10". I think 7 foot is a little bit too tall for the game, even.
But he's not 6'10".
6'8". No, not even that. 6'6". But he knows where the ball's going to go. He knows trajectory. He knows where it's going to... There's a picture of him perfectly perpendicular to the floor, diving for the ball like this in front of Roger Ebert, you know, the guy that used to be the film, who's on the front row seat. And he's got the ball in his hand. He's ready to get it out and throw it. But he's perpendicular, like laid out completely. Yeah. He spent a lot of time on the floor. A lot of time getting knocked down and banged around. Loved it. Just loved it. It's like a rubber ball bouncing up and down.
Yeah.
There's a cartoon character like that. I can't remember who it is. But
when you're on the sidelines watching the game, do you ever pray?
I pray before the ball game when they're doing the national anthem.
Beautiful.
Let me be a vessel.
Yes. Beautiful.
Yeah, you know, my dad was a minister. My mom was a minister.
Both.
Both of them. Attended the same Bible school in Winnipeg, Manitoba, back in the 20s. Dates us 100 years ago. And they were moved by this charismatic movement that went across the country in the United States. My dad was a dairy farmer. My mom was young. She'd just come out of a teaching, one-room schoolhouse teaching in Montana. So I was born into this family, sister and two brothers, four of us. And
where were you in the four?
I was the youngest.
Youngest.
So I was a war baby at the end of the war baby in 45, not a baby boomer in 46. But, you know, it was, you know, an interesting time. People coming out of depression, out of poverty that came out of the depression. And the West was, you know, hamstrung really by Dust Bowl and loss of jobs and farmers losing their land and so forth.
You know, people don't know about the Dust Bowl anymore, but was it 3 years where basically the sun didn't shine?
Well, it was just drought and wind. My mom, who grew up there, my dad didn't grow up in the West. My dad grew up in Ontario, Canada, really on the Quebec border, Ottawa River, and migrated out to marry my mom. And even though they'd both gone to a seminary in Winnipeg, Manitoba, that was by chance and choice because there weren't a whole lot of charismatic seminaries at that time. So anyway, he came out west and loved it, loved Montana and the open spaces. His family had migrated from what was Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
They were Tories,
mm-hmm.
loyalists. And they went to Nova Scotia, and then they got a land grant for losing their land
mm-hmm.
in what became New Hampshire, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. But that time, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts incorporated that land, Portsmouth. But my mom, growing up, had she was from a Mennonite faith, and her parents had migrated in 1902 from Minnesota to Saskatchewan, and she was born there in 07, and then they had the epidemic that was devastating, the flu, or Spanish flu, which it was called, which took three of her five cousins. They went together as a married couple, my grandpa Funk and my uncle Reimer. They're German Mennonites. The Reimers lost three of their five kids to this epidemic, and they gave it up, and they went back and homesteaded in Montana. But the story I was going to tell, my mom would tell about the locusts coming through and would strip the clothesline of clothes and take the tails off the horses and the manes and just eat everything, strip the land. And they called them the Rocky Mountain Locust Invasion. And
that's wild.
I know. It's like,
it's biblical.
At hypnoticcoffee.com. I think I had a technical difficulty there. So make sure, I wanted to say,